I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and this is The Legacy Tapes. Before we get cracking with today's podcast, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a warning. This was recorded in the function room of a pub on a very noisy street in Paddington. We hoped that it would work, but unfortunately there was a problem with the window and we couldn't close it. So you're going to hear a little bit of street noise. But I think the conversation is interesting enough that won't be too much of a problem. But, you know, do just forgive me. I'm sorry that your listening pleasure will not be as mellifluous as I would have hoped. Anyway, enjoy the podcast. Hi, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and you are listening to The Legacy Tapes, a series of conversations with artistic leaders focused on how you might be able to leave something lasting in the ephemeral world of theatre, or not, if you choose not to. I'm here with Cully Thiare. Great. Who is the Artistic Director and Chief Executive at National Theatre Wales. Before that, she was the Exec Director at Cast in Doncaster, and before that she was Artistic Director at Contact in Manchester and Leicester Haymarket. So you've been all over the country.
Yeah, I have.
You know Britain pretty damn well. And you've been through lots of organisations. What have in as part of that journey, have you felt the burden of taking on those organisations or buildings at any given point? Or is it always a light-shouldered joy?
No, I'd never call it a light-shouldered joy, I don't think. I mean, it's interesting how I've ended up, and at what point I've ended up leading organisations. My very first artistic director's job was with Red Ladder, which was a national touring company based in Leeds. And it's not so much the position that I think was onerous. I think it was to do with more my race, my gender, that felt, because I was, you know, I was quite a novelty when I started out. I mean, you know, there was Tara in London and Talawar, I think, were around, and Black Theatre Co-op, but there weren't many artists of colour working in significant positions. And if they were running BME-led organisations. So I guess there was an interesting, nobody actually said it to me, but there was sort of an undercurrent of, oh, what does that mean for Red Ladder?
Yeah. So you didn't have the luxury of not being political.
No, and of course, you know, one of the joys of taking over a company like Red Ladder Theatre Company was that it was rooted in a socialist feminist theatre movement.
Yeah.
And so actually there was some of what I was bringing recognised that politic, and therefore, and my artistic life had begun helping Red Ladder out. I didn't come through the theatre world. I didn't go through drama school. I didn't have an English degree. I trained as a social worker in Bradford, and did an applied social studies degree at theatre at Bradford University, and happened to fall into Theatre in the Mill, and meet Ruth McKenzie. I mean, you know, those are accidents of sort of circumstance that actually allowed a whole other world to open up to me. So I think the burden of leadership has been less about, sometimes it has been about the role and the kind of expectation, but I think that expectation is more complex when you're someone like me.
Yeah,
you know, who's a working class kid from the Midlands.
Yeah,
where is not supposed to, from Smethwick.
I'm from Wolverhampton.
Well, round the corner.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone who's not expected to get to aspire to very much. And so, you know, that and as a woman, and as a woman of colour, and as a million other things, you know, that you that you're, how people perceive you, what they expect of you, is quite interesting.
So can you talk a little bit more about that? What did people expect of you? What was the weight of that identity that they ascribed to you?
In the arts world, I think quite often either they didn't expect very much, or what they wanted was for you to fulfill some of their narratives, you know, some of their politics or some of their sort of aspiration, which might not always align with yours, but in the modern day we might perceive that to be, you know, that they wanted to tick a box and say we've got a black person doing this, or we've got a woman doing that. I mean, that stuff hasn't changed. Sometimes that was very subtle, sometimes it was very and I think sometimes I do remember very, very clearly going to an equity meeting in London. And people talking to me and confusing me with the only other actress that was from the north of England. In fact, she was from somewhere like Manchester or something. And then, you know, suddenly realising that these were in the days when I was a stage manager, and I kind of went, how curious that, you know, and that the expectation was that you would then go and work for Tara Arts, because that was the obvious place for you. And I think what drives me and what's interesting as a consequence of that is that I have actively gone against that all of my life, in a way. So when there's been schemes and programs that are, diversity driven, my instinct has always been that's not what I'm going to do.
That's not what defines me.
Because it puts me in a box that I don't want to be put in. And that, you know, sometimes that comes with its own challenges because you are perceived to be outside of the kind of structures that are created for you.
Yeah.
But that's also been the thing that's allowed me to get away with doing all sorts of things that have caused ripples of, either ripples of sort of action, or have kind of allowed me to kind of make a proposition that perhaps wasn't expected. And I think that's been part of my journey ever since, really. And I still find myself in those moments, you know, where people want you to talk about diversity and your role and all that kind of stuff, all of which is really important stuff. I'm not saying that it's not important stuff, or I'm not saying that I don't want to be part of that, because that is a responsibility one carries. And you know that you are creating and churning up the ground around you sometimes in order for it to be easier for the future, for the generation behind you.
Okay, so let's talk about that then, because even before we get to organisations, I guess there's the legacy of you as a person existing in this ecology. Do you feel a responsibility, or again like that kind of weight, or do you have an eye to the future and what the people coming up behind you might experience? Like, do you feel like you need to be an ambassador or an icebreaker or whatever the right metaphor for that is?
I've always, whether it's been in the early days of growing up in Smethwick, I found myself trying to find justice for people, including myself. That I've always felt this huge sense of that life can be very unfair for people, and what is it that you can do to make it better? And particularly for young Asian women that I was encountering, and my own experience was that so little was expected of you and so little was offered to you that actually you had to fight for everything. And that fight came sometimes with very harsh consequences. And I think in the world of the arts, we also recognise that, you know, in order to succeed somehow as a woman or and as a working class woman, and then on top of that as a working class Asian woman, there is a challenge to you to prove yourself, and so by you place that on yourself as a burden, but there's also an expectation that you feel you've got to do better than anybody else around you in order to justify being in the room with everybody else. And so I think that is a drive that is inherent in me. But also I think that I do feel a sense of that I have a duty to support and make it easier for people that are wanting to be in the arts and wanting to have these opportunities who maybe haven't been given them very easily. And so I suppose part of my legacy is trying to do that. And also I think I just like being mischievous, I guess. You know, that I want everybody to be more curious with the world. I want people to question the way that things exist.
Yeah.
You know, and why should we all go to a theatre building that's structured in a particular way? Why should London only be the centre of excellence? Why can't you be perceived to be doing brilliant work just because you happen to want to stay in a city or a town or a place where perhaps there isn't as much opportunity for culture, and culture needs more investment and more of your energies and more talent to stay there. And so I think my curiosity and my determination to show that things are possible when everybody's telling you they aren't possible is what has been the thing that's given me sort of purpose, I guess. And linked to that is the possibility that all of us can do all sorts of things if we're enabled to do them.
That sense, I certainly find that. It's like when someone clearly thinks you can't do it, just that sense of, well, fuck them. I'm gonna show them.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be a real boost, really. So
combined with, I think, having some people in the right places at the right time believing in you to say, so, you know, for me, there were certain figures who just want to, you know, I think you should do this, Cully. Or what? Or I think you should be in the arts, you'd be great, or whatever. Whoever those people were, I think we all have them, whether that's a brilliant teacher or a brilliant, you know, arts individual. You know, for me, they were Ruth McKenzie and at Theatre and Mill, who started me in the world of theatre, and seeing work there was very inspirational, but also she was incredibly supportive. And then, you know,
Theatre and the Mill's going to I'm just going to make a little bit of noise. I'm just going to shut this window because it won't shut. We'll live with it. Edit that bit out again, Tim. I think Theatre and the Mill's been a real, it's amazing what a boost that place has been to so many people's careers, actually. And I guess it's because it exists in that academic space where you're just free to question.
But also it's because I think it's partly that it's not an arts organised, it's not an arts university, you know. It's certainly when I was there, it was known for its engineering and its foreign languages and its peace studies and its, so, you know, it didn't have sort of English and drama and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, those were, so the fact that it wasn't aligned, it was your personal,
it's different,
extra world.
And it's the kind of different ways of thinking boshing up against each other.
Yeah.
So let's talk about National Theatre of Wales.
Yeah.
And then we'll maybe move backwards.
Yeah.
So four, man. Like, because it's, I think it's a, like, the idea of taking over a national organisation has such,
scary,
has such weight.
Yeah, it's scary.
And especially an organisation that's so recently founded.
Yeah, and so wonderfully led by John. Yeah.
With such, I mean, they're big shoes. How was that? Like, what was it that you felt like you inherited? And how was that?
Well, it was, I feel really, really privileged to have been asked to lead such a wonderful organisation. And I, you know, it is daunting, of course it's daunting. And the burden of expectation on you to fulfil those hefty shoes is huge. But the flip side of that is that, you know, I have a long association with the company. I have a long association with John. And, you know, I was made one of the shows in the inaugural, in their inaugural season. So I feel in some respects I was returning to somewhere familiar. And it felt like, and there is a sort of family there already. And I feel sort of, I was sort of rather overwhelmed by the response to the announcement that I'd been given the job, because the positivity around it all was quite extraordinary. And so sort of, it left me speechless, you know, because it was just wonderful to receive that kind of support. So I feel very welcomed into all of that. And I think the biggest challenge for me is that I realise until very recently, every organisation I've run, I've gone into it at a period of crisis. And that actually, it's been given to me at a point when nobody else wants to deal with it, in a way, and you're not expecting it to succeed in very, you know, people don't have that expectation that you'll be able to pull it off, and when you do, somehow
it's brilliant.
Of kind of, they look at you with rather a bit of surprise, but it also has meant that, you know, it's the energy of coming into this organisation means that I need to think about it slightly differently, because actually it's not about needing to kind of firefight my way through. It's about building on a really strong legacy and actually looking at what the next chapter of an organisation is. And it's timely, and it's, you know, we're not a startup anymore. We've sort of got, we've landed, and people know who we are and what we do. Now it's about consolidating and growing and you know, bringing finesse and more detail into how we can do things better and in more depth. But you know, the values of the company I absolutely hold dear to me, and I think what we really want to strive to do is, you know, look at how we continue to be radical and relevant at the same time, how we continue to be at the forefront of boldness and bravery around the work we make, and the kind of core relationship with place and people, and how that defines the kind of work we might make and how we might make it.
Because that's, I mean, I think that's really exciting about how NTW thinks about nationhood. You know, like earlier in the series, I was chatting to John, and he was talking about figuring out nationhood. Like, what's that? Because I guess you will come to an understanding of your own about that. Like what does it mean to be? I mean, because you're kind of defining the canon in a way, or are you? I don't know. Argue with me. What does it mean to you to be the curator of a nation's?
We've just done this extraordinary weekend, City of the Unexpected, which has just been.
Saw the pictures of the giant peach.
Yeah, the giant peach and the high wire acts and fantastic Mr. Fox and hundreds of thousands of people lining the streets of Cardiff, and there was some international delegates from around the world that the British Council had invited across to see, and to spend the weekend with us. And in fact, I was talking to the British Council this morning, and they said, "Oh, interestingly, one of the sort of themes that kept coming through from the international delegates was they didn't feel it was very Welsh." And I sort of went, "Oh, I wonder what that means." We're kind of interesting to kind of go, what's their perception of Welsh mean? You know, and is that about Cardiff, or is that about something else that they're holding on to? So I think it's some really interesting questions about what it means to be Welsh, what does it mean to be English, what does it mean to be Scottish, what does it mean to be British? And actually for me, in my context, with my background, those questions of identity and how you defined identity and how you perceive culture and the complexity of all of those ideas are such rich vein, because there is no singular way of viewing that,
because everyone's Welsh or everyone's is different.
It's different. It's absolutely different, you know. And And so I think that's such a rich territory for the arts to be exploring, and for a conversation to be had about defining the world we live in.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, what Wales was pre-Brexit, what Wales might be post-Brexit, what the UK is, what its relationship to its, you know...
What the hell are we doing?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think we're in a world of chaos.
Yeah.
And in
yeah.
that chaos is a huge amount of complexity.
Mm.
And in that complexity are individuals who are made up of some really, you know, whole load of stuff that's not easy to define.
Yeah, really quite conflicting thing. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that that's interesting. I've been really aware of post referendum, actually, is that I really felt like I had a sense of what Britishness and what British values were. And I don't mean the nostalgic bullshit that gets trotted out as a cover for bigotry, but like the actual texture of us as a collective. And actually, post Brexit, I find that certainty undermined.
Yeah.
And I don't quite know. Like, I remember having a conversation with an elderly Australian gentleman about the NHS and about social welfare, and feeling really quite, you know, only 5 years ago or something, and feeling really quite secure in the knowledge of fairness and justice as part of that social structure, or the aspiration for that, even if there's a failure. And now I wouldn't be able to make that case.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think
the whole world is in a state of crisis. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think the times we're living in are kind of dangerous in all sorts of ways. You know, and in some ways, the kind of, you know, the big anxiety for me is not just the poverty of lack of money and wealth, you know, defined through wealth. It's the poverty of the imagination. It's the poverty of aspiration. People talk about, you know, arts buildings, arts organisations, kind of being in artistic, in kind of financial crisis. But actually, they can be in great financial health and absolutely be artistically bankrupt.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like
emotionally,
I think we're in a place of bankruptcy because I don't think we are embracing our generosity and our humanity collectively in a way that we should be. And I think we're being told a certain narrative. There isn't the narrative of most people, actually. I think most people do have a good heart. Most people do want to live in, you know, they're not driven purely for selfish reasons. And I think if we in the arts world can help create a space where generosity and the collective spirit
is acknowledged, or
it's just recognized, you know, and actually that we can find a place for discussion and debate and provocation that allows us all to be richer for it, because we all can find a way through the darker days that we're facing in order to find and help shape a better future, then you know, that must surely be the role of us as theatre makers and as artists in enabling that community to come together and make something possible that everybody thinks is impossible. Because the meta narrative of, you know, divide and rule is disgraceful.
Yeah.
And if there's any sense of despair I feel over the last 18 months, it has been that our newspapers, our media and our politicians have behaved atrociously.
Yeah. Unforgivable.
And, you know, and have created, and deliberately created, in my view, a sense of pitching one group against another group. For their own power base and the strengthening of their own positions, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you do that enough times, if you tell people enough times they're not worthy, they begin to accept they're not worthy. You know, I certainly grew up thinking that I couldn't do anything because all my teachers decided I couldn't, you know, wouldn't be able to do it. So, you know, there are communities who feel abandoned and believe there is nothing out there for them, and yet you offer them something. And certainly for me, one of the biggest, you know, things I'm proudest of in Doncaster is that, you know, in a very contested landscape, building, you know, launching a brand new theatre venue, which nobody felt that they wanted because actually their everyday living concerns weren't being met by the council. Suddenly, you know, galvanised a community and it became the cultural living room for the town, and people committed to it and suddenly found that they had a voice and they were being seen and they could hold their heads up high and be proud of something in their town that belonged to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think there's lots and lots of communities who feel abandoned, who feel that they have no voice, and I think, you know, Brexit is a consequence of some of a lot of that. Sorry, that's deviated us in a long way off from running buildings.
Well, it sort of is and it isn't, because one of my questions, or one of the things that I want to know is, you know, why do you do this? Why the hell? Why this? And, like, do you...
Because I'm insane.
So it's a masochist.
Yeah.
And kind of linked into that is this sense that do you think theatre or performance or whatever comes under this umbrella of art can elicit change? Does it have an impact in a meaningful way? And I feel like those things are probably linked, or maybe not.
I think it depends on what you mean by change. I think art can have a profound impact on people, and I've seen that and I've witnessed that, and I'm also aware that having done work in particular contexts and being who I am and the visibility that has given, that has impacted on young people who then come into the profession because they've seen someone like me doing it. And those things are real and tangible consequences of the work we make. I'm also aware that, you know, there's vast amounts of money invested in the arts, which is only seen by a very small percentage of people, and those people are from a very narrow group in its own right. So clearly there is a big problem, and it's a big problem that we are not dealing with very effectively, which is that for a large proportion of the population, the arts is perceived to be not for them.
Yeah.
And we make derisory, I would say, opportunities to try and do something about it. We're very articulate about all the challenges that we have about not being able to do anything about it and legitimising why it's a problem and why more money is needed. But actually, the reality is that that offer never changes. And you only have to look at the theatre programmes to know what the canon is and should be, and what do you do if it's not that, and where you're perceived to be in the pecking order in relation to that. And I think one of the, you know, one of the interesting things for me is that I've ended up getting jobs where I suspect the real artistic directors probably wouldn't have wanted to go for it, or because it's not going to get them to the places that they perceive themselves to want to be.
I'm pretty sure National Theatre of Wales is that's a golden goose.
I know, but I don't think anybody expected me to get that, did they, really? I don't know. No, absolutely, but, you know, I sort of contact was in crisis when I first went there, and at that point, you know, there was the chair of the board and some board members who sort of said to me, we think we want to return to finding a way of making it a place for young people. Do you think that's possible? And and it was an opportunity to kind of model up something completely new. Mm. And I'd been asked to do that because I'd been, I guess, partly running, specialising in making work for young
mm.
people. And I do remember really clearly the funders pulling money away, board members feeling uncomfortable about the direction of potential.
Because it wasn't buying into the existing value system.
Yeah, because it was going to be different.
Mm.
It was going to be different and nobody was doing it.
Yeah.
That wasn't the world
yeah.
anybody recognised. And I also remember somebody really categorically said, do you think this is going to work? Can you, actually the phrase was, can you guarantee me this will work? And I'm kind of going, no, but I think it has everybody, you know.
Definition of work.
Yeah, but also, you know, we know these component bits all work, so
mm.
why wouldn't? If you have a level of integrity about your intention,
mm.
then of course it will work. You know, somebody else sort of said to me, it'll just be a glorified youth club, a very expensive glorified youth club,
mm.
and you kind of go, that's really interesting that you're already making judgments on what you think young people want or don't want from
mm.
an arts, you know. And then of course John came in and took that vision and made it into
mm.
this extraordinary building, and the legacy of which, you know, still
yeah.
persists strongly now.
Yeah, I mean, it is routinely held up as
yeah, as an international exemplar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the, you know, the same is true of some of the of things like Doncaster, like Cass, where because nobody expected it
mm.
to work, you were allowed to do things that were quite radical that nobody knew they were radical because nobody had done them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It gives you freedom.
Yeah. So that, you know, and you know, I have to say in that context, without, you know, huge support from the Arts Council, who, you know, in fact it was the Arts Council who said to me, I think you're doing things radical that nobody even notices that they're radical. So it's really interesting that sometimes it's the, you can break rules when, you know, it's broken already, it's so broken that it can't get any worse.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
So. I've been in interviews where people have, you know, the questions pre-interview that they ask you, and you go, that's an outrageous question to be asking. And, you know, it's to do with who you know and what
mm.
your relationship to X or Y is in London and who's in your address book. And you think, I thought we lived in a more, I'd like to have thought, you know, we lived in a different world to the world you're just, I'm just
yeah.
experiencing now. And so am I on your list because you just need someone to tick certain boxes, or do you genuinely want somebody to kind of bring a new way of running
yeah.
this regional theatre or that regional
yeah.
theatre? You know, and so I think it's, there is an interesting challenge posed by people by my presence in some ways, you know.
Mm.
But it's great, you know, it's great that the landscape has, is changing quite significantly. You know, I don't feel quite like I'm the only one around now with Indu at the Tricycle
mm.
and
yeah.
know, all that.
I was talking to Natalie Ibu
mm.
this morning, and she was talking about that sense of being second generation and complexly identified, and people assuming simplicity, like ascribing
yeah,
simplistic
emotion.
Identity
yeah.
to her and all sorts of things, and her and a certain degree of weariness at always having to fight the fight, because to exist in the world you fight the fight. I wanted to ask you about that a little bit, because so much of what you're talking about is this, like, bugger you all, I'm gonna carry on, I'm soldiering on. And how does that affect, you know, how does that affect you? What's the impact of that, the legacy of that in you?
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It is really, really exhausting. And I sort of, I think you end up doubting yourself all of the time,
mm.
because the forces against you are quite, they're constant, they're
mm.
constant battering, and sometimes incredibly subtle, you know. I mean, I think those are the most, those are the toughest ones actually. You can fight the fight when it's really clear.
Mm.
It's much harder to fight the fight when it's just nuanced comments, or just a feeling you get,
mm.
or a look that you might have, or walking into a room where there's nobody even remotely like you.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that just in terms of my colour. I just mean, because I know that I can walk into a room, you know, that sometimes I have more in common with a white working class kid,
yeah, it's more
than I do have a, you know, an
yeah.
Asian person that happens to, you know, from who might be Hindu or whatever, you
yeah.
know. It's so there's a great deal of complexity around
mm.
that the world you inhabit. I think the hardest thing about it all, where it really is, the emotional internalizing that you do,
mm-hmm.
because actually there's very few people you can talk about those things to.
Mm.
And I think that's probably finding the sort of places to vent some of that,
mm.
so that you're not just carrying it in the pit of your stomach all the time.
Yeah.
That sort of constant anxiety about what it is you're doing and how you're doing it.
Yeah, and it's really hard then not to, just transposing this into my experience, like it's really hard then not to expect or preempt those things and alter your behaviour in a way that you might actually not want to.
Mm.
Like I'm really aware, there was a period not so long ago, quite a short period, where I went through 5 different artistic leader recruitment processes, and in every, I wonder if I should talk about this in the podcast, never mind. And in every case, women made up 80 of the 5 candidates. 4 of them were always women. Very rarely any of them weren't white, but 4 of them were always women. And of the panels, of a panel of 5, 4 of them were always men. And in every case, the guy got the job. Every case. And I feel as though if it was half the time, then it's probably the best person. But in every case, and now I often go into those conversations and I look at the panel and I'm like, ugh. And I have to work really hard not to give up, not to be angry at them,
mm.
not to, you know, just to manage that.
Mm.
That. And it must be so much worse. It must be, I mean, God, I haven't seen. And I look relative, you know, I look relatively mainstream.
Mm.
I look like a female default male.
Mm.
So it must be so much more of an obstacle. Just that, like, oh for fuck, just that oh for fuck's sake again, every time.
Mm. But sometimes, you know, sometimes you know that even when you're going into stuff. I mean, I knew, I won't name names in these contexts, but
mm.
I knew going into a particular job that I was never going to get it, and I wasn't sure I wanted it,
mm.
but I knew I wasn't going to get it,
mm.
and not because I couldn't do it. You know, absolutely knew I could do it standing on my head, and that actually if I was given the opportunity, a lot of the issues that they were facing we could overcome,
mm.
because I brought that level of experience to them.
Yeah.
Knew I wouldn't get it, was contemplating whether, what was the point of applying. But it's really important sometimes to just throw
just
your hat in the ring,
mm.
because, and it was, you know, I was seen, you know, I got through to however many rounds it got, you know, it was endless interviews. But I think you sometimes, you do have to just be present,
mm.
because it's being present, even if you don't succeed, being present makes a difference.
Mm.
Not in the immediate term, but in the longer term.
Yeah.
And somehow, you know, suddenly, I mean, I just find it hilarious because suddenly in the last 6 months I'm being asked to sit on boards that are so grand that I would never have been allowed to sit on, you know, and there are moments when you sort of go, do I really want, is this really where I want to be, what I want to do?
Mm.
And then there's other times you go, actually, I can make a difference here. It's going to be tough, but sometimes if they're really genuine and want to have that conversation about engagement and about culture and about how you might become more accessible and more open and more porous as an organisation, then I'm really willing to do that. And I sometimes have to, you know, you do sometimes have to step up to the plate and go, yeah, okay.
I'm here.
I'm here and I'm present, and my presence is going to make a difference. It might not change the world immediately, but it's going to create enough ripples for some of them to land, and for some of that to make a difference in the longer term.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always, you know, my dear friend Noel Gregg, who's a playwright, always used to say, you know, that theatre was about trying to disturb the air a little.
Mm.
And I think that's such a wonderful phrase, because I think that is what you want to do in that collective room together as performers with your audience, is to disturb the air enough for people to kind of
feel
see something new or discover something, refresh something, you know. And I think we have to think about, in those sorts of ways, about where might our presence, even if it's uncomfortable sometimes for us, make that difference.
That's a really nice way to think about it. Yeah, sometimes just showing up and being there is the thing.
And shouting and screaming is not always going to be the way to make that difference happen.
Mm.
But I think, you know, how you make yourself heard is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I was listening, and I can't remember who this was, but I was listening to, I think, some famous female professor who said one of the things she teaches her female students is, when you go into a meeting, speak early. Speak early, make your voice heard in the room early, because people are tuned to the tone in the room. And if you leave it too late, it becomes as a female voice when it's predominantly male coming in too late. Well, causes more disruption later on, so it doesn't get heard in the same way.
Yeah.
I thought, that's interesting psychology. That
it's just literally set the tone.
It's literally, your voice will sound different to the ears of everybody else around the table. So if you say something early on, then it's more established than if you leave it too late. And I thought, gosh, you know, there's so much about the way our structures are set up, the way that kind of things that frame every encounter you have as to how people perceive you and what the offer is in that moment, and how much you therefore receive or reject what that encounter is made up of. And I think, you know, those of us who live with all of this complexity, I think we're more attuned to how people might be feeling, and therefore probably more open and more supportive of that. Whereas if you have been in a world where there's never been any question of your presence in that place, where that sense of entitlement and purpose is been with you all your life, how would you ever know what it feels like
to not have that
or to feel that you've got that sense of entitlement? You've earned that sense of entitlement, but still the feeling that you're a bit of a fraud. You know, I mean, the complexity around the sort of emotional arc of how we live our lives is very, very interesting in our world of theatre.
Yeah, and I think often I find a real conflict between what we think we are, which is liberal and progressive and innovative and open and generous.
We're not at all.
Conservative little reactionary buggers, all of us.
Yeah.
And just managing that assumption of self, and the reality I find quite quite challenging.
Yeah. No, I think we like to think of ourselves as innovators, and we're not. We shy away from. We're incredibly risk averse. We're incredibly narrow in our thinking. I think we, you know, as you say, I think we're very, very conservative, and we play with, you know, who do we know that makes us feel comfortable, and let's stay in our comfort zone, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's much more interesting when you're outside of your comfort zone, trying stuff that's, you know, and I think theatre should have that element of danger all of the time. There shouldn't be any certainty to whether what you're making is going to land in the right way, because we're not, you know, sometimes it's the randomness of something that creates extraordinary moments and extraordinary encounters, not the detailed, you know, that's worked before, it'll work again. Well, no, it won't, because everything changes.
Yeah.
You know,
the light is falling differently today.
Yeah. The group of people in that room is different. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I go, at what point are we all going to say, we've had enough of, we love Shakespeare, but can we do something else for a bit? You know, but that sort of sense of how do we create, I mean, and my biggest anxiety which really is how do we create the canon of our world as it is now? How do we tell the stories of our time? That's our responsibility. How do we capture and tell the stories of our time?
Because we're really...
And we're not doing it.
We're not, and we're really behind on that.
Yeah, we're not doing it. And where we are doing it, there's extraordinary works and extraordinary artists coming forward. But, you know, they're in the margins, and, you know, they're not getting the resource or the investments or the levels that where they really could take those imaginative leaps and really make something startling and wonderful. And you know, not in the numbers anyway that they need to be in order to kind of really feed that base, in order to kind of have extraordinary stuff coming to the top, you know. I mean, I just think we've got such a short-term mentality about.
So I had an argument about this exact thing with someone that I care quite deeply about recently, and after seeing a show which had 17 cast members, only five of which were female, and one of which wasn't white. And it was one of those shows where you sit and you calculate the
cost,
the running cost, and you're like, fucking hell, I could run a theatre for years on this show. I went with my friend, and he was saying that. And I was like, this, and we came out, and I was like, this makes me, I'm angry. Like, there's probably, it was fine, it was pretty. I don't understand why do I give a shit this story? I don't care. But I'm angry that it even exists. I'm angry that we're doing this play again in this adaptation by the same old kind of person with the same old. I'm angry. And my companion kindly responded, well, what do? Do you rule out 90% of human culture? Do we stop producing those things? And it brought me up short a little bit, because in my fury I wanted to be like, yes, they've had thousands of years, now it's someone else's turn.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know if that's actually the solution, and I don't know if I really think that. But I certainly don't. I don't want any more of that. You know, what is the, like, in terms of how we make this canon, how can we, on what we've got, what should we do?
I mean, I suppose the thing for me is that we have to find a way of trusting artists and investing in artists. What we tend not to invest in artists. And also, we've got a system whereby if you want to have the big money to play with, you have to play by those particular rules. And so you can't detract from those directors who suddenly go, actually, I want to work with X. And quite often those artistic directors or those theatres will be saying, so what's the what's the play you really want to do, you know, and often, it's quite often things that are well known or whatever. Very
because
few,
you don't know what doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, you know, how do you pitch ideas around, you know, because around something you might make that could go anywhere. So there's something about the way the whole structure is set up that makes it really, really problematic. I mean, I'm not one of those. I completely understand your frustration, and I completely understand the rage because I feel it too at times. But I don't necessarily believe that you have to get rid of all of that in order to
get the other.
I do either.
No.
But I think we have to find a way of rebalancing some stuff, and the rebalancing of some of that stuff is about. It's not that these big institutions are used to having lots and lots of money. There's lots and lots of artists who make work on Tuppence Halfpenny, and are not used to working with lots of money. And I think there's an interesting dichotomy there because actually. You know, making a saving of, you know, £50,000 by structuring a particular cost in a big multi-million pound institution. And I know this as an example, because I was told that there was an issue in a big house a few years ago, and this person had gone in and to do some consultancy with them, and kind of looked at how restructuring would solve a whole load of issues for them and save them £100,000 a year. And they never implemented any of those things because they perceived it as being too difficult to do. But in that parameter, their £100,000 to them was not. Very much was not a grand
and yet there are
saving.
NPOs whose entire annual budget is less than that.
Is that absolutely? And he was. I remember. I was. You know, shouldn't really be talking about it, I suppose. But you know, hearing that when we were sort of, you know, scrabbling around trying to get Doncaster on its feet, you know, and also knowing that 100,000 in someone else's, that saving in someone else's world would be transformative to such. A degree, and yet there was this complacency that was going.
Meh.
Oh, I don't think I fancy sorting that out really, because there wasn't any real pressure on them to do it. So I think there is some sort of shaking up that we really, really need to do, and I think we require some brave souls to do a bit of that. But I also think that. You know, until we, I don't know, maybe more things need to go into crisis before they'll let us relook at new models or alternative models, which is a sad indictment, really. But I do have to reflect on my history and go, yeah, it's interesting, you know, the places I've made things happen, they've been at a point of crisis in order where we've had to.
Has to be nothing to lose before you take the risk.
Yeah, and that's a shame because we ought to be bold enough to try new things. But you know, things are led by individuals ultimately, and so if you get the right people in those positions of power, and you have I think the other issue around governance and all that kind of stuff, because that's a whole. Minefield in itself, you know. Those you need that sort of ability to be able to shake things up, and also go in the short term. It might all be to change something of those, you know. Big
it might be a disaster for a bit.
For you have to follow it through.
Make
you
a
have
mess.
To, yeah, you've got to make a real mess, and you've got to. Yeah, you've got to really think about it. What will it look like in 10, 15 years' time? And how, and it will be painful, you know. Nothing new comes out of something without a bit of pain, really.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what's interesting about, you know, organisations like National Theatre of Wales is that they're a new breed, and the new breed has got a different energy. But what it's much harder, and you know, to do something with an existing thing because there's so much investment in the bricks and mortar, in the people, in the history, in the and making change in those sorts of places can be much, much tougher. I don't know, I'm rambling because I don't think I can give you a clear answer to how do we make change happen. I think we're stagnating in some in many ways, in many places.
I guess either very slowly and incrementally or by staging the revolution.
Yeah.
It's going to be one or the other.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So then I guess probably my last umbrella question is, what do you want or what do you think your legacy will be? And I think it's like a three-parter. There's like, there's you as like an individual artist, or you know, artist producer, however you point yourself, you as a person, you here at NTW. Like, what do you want to leave behind? And then let's like fast forward many decades to the end of your time here, and what do you want? Like, what do you want us to say in your epilogue? Epilogue? Eulogy.
I don't know. God, she survived. blimey. I suppose the greatest joy I get in terms of my legacy or who I am is... it's partly realizing that there are people who've made a career in their arts because of something I did or was involved in, not necessarily me as an artist, but something I helped make happen.
Yeah.
And that it had a direct impact on a bunch of people that are now making great work or involved in the arts in some way, and I think. I feel I'm touched that they've done that, but I also feel proud that's been possible because of some of the choices we've made or I've made at times. So, I mean, you know, I have moments when I think, you know, I gave Roy Williams his first commission ever, and every now and again I think, oh, you know, that's great, you know, he's one of our biggest successes,
and one of his plays was the first piece of new writing I ever saw.
Oh really?
So from that you kind of get a knock on, right?
Yeah. And you know, I remember him coming in and we did a wonderful evaluation with him at the end of his commission and the piece of work we made, we did an evaluation which was through a drawing exercise as if it was a travel. Yeah, it was a travel map, and he created this wonderful airplane. And he said, you know, how much myself and Noel Gregg, who was his dramaturg on the project, how we were like his, like air attendants, you know, looking after him. And when every now and again he'd hit a bit of turbulence, and we'd be right there. And you know, it was just a lovely image of kind of floating through, sort of going on this journey together, you know, and. Flight attendants as theatre makers, and so for him learning his craft as he went through, you know, I sort of still think, you know, and he's continuing to make political work and important work, and he's being recognised as part of our modern contemporary world, you know, and I'm delighted that I had some involvement in making that possible. And you know, the same is true for some of the artists. You know, in fact, over this weekend, somebody said to me, "You gave me my first job," and you know, you forget how much those things matter to people, especially people who, you know, are from Black and Asian communities or artists with disabilities who, you know, you've kind of created access opportunities for people. In terms of National Theatre Wales, you know, I hope we will carry on being an adventurous, joyous, naughty company, trying to do things that are trying to do the impossible.
Yeah.
Really. And
seems like that is what that company does.
Yeah. Yeah. And
if you look at a lot of it on paper, you're like, no.
Yeah, absolutely. And I sort of it feels a little bit like, you know, oh well, all of the things I've all done all across all these years suddenly coming to a kind of satellite in this one company, you know, in terms of, you know, working with the communities or working in locations and in specific places, trying to seed better whole ecology of the arts in the nation, you know, to support the growth in other people's talent and investing in ideas and encouraging people to be brave about what they want to say and how they want to say it and not follow the rules necessarily. Mm. You know, those feel like there's a coming together of all of those values and passions and experiences that I've had. Gosh, and what might they say at the end?
Or what's your Encyclopedia Britannica entry? Or, you know, you can frame it however you like.
I don't know. I suppose she knocked down a few walls. you know, she broke down a few doors. I suppose my epitaph might be, there's no such thing as you can't do it.
Mm.
You know, I think you say that to me and I'll find a way of saying, yes, you can.
Yeah. That's really nice. That's a nice thing to take out into the world.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I hope so. Yes, you can. And if I've encouraged one or two people to do that and believe that that's possible, then that's great.
I think that's a really nice place to finish. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.